From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in what is now Eastern Germany in the late 1700s. Schools began to organize students in a kind of factory-like setting. Prussian King Frederick the Great wanted to create an efficient model that would be top-down, designed to produce students who could serve societal needs. In the United States, Michigan adopted that model in 1835, and then the secretary of the Massachusetts Board of Education, Horace Mann, traveled to Prussia. Mann had been searching for the best system to bolster literacy, and he chose the Prussian model. By the dawn of the 20th century, every American state had adopted a similar school setup, and it hardly looks any different today. Is that a testament to the wisdom of this school design, or are we adhering to a system that should be retired? I first became interested in the question of how to redesign school days from scratch after listening to a talk from Ken Robinson, the British educational consultant who's probably best known for his TED Talk, which happens to be the most watched TED Talk ever. But the clip you're about to hear is from a different presentation in which Robinson made several arguments. The first is that the classroom itself is a relic from a different era. And the second is that the educational approach is stifling and reflects values that do a disservice to many children. Let's listen.
The problem is that the current system of education was designed and conceived and structured for a different age. It was conceived in the intellectual culture of the Enlightenment and in the economic circumstances of the Industrial Revolution. Schools are still pretty much organized on factory lines, ringing bells, separate facilities, specialized into separate subjects. We still educate children by batches. You know, we put them through the system by age group. Why do we do that? You know, why is there this assumption that the most important thing kids have in common is how old they are? You know, it's like the most important thing about them is their date of manufacture. You know what I mean? Well, I know kids who are much better than other kids at the same age in different disciplines, you know, or at different times of the day, or better in smaller groups than in large groups, or sometimes they want to be on their own. If you're interested in the model of learning, you don't start from this production line mentality. It's essentially about conformity, and increasingly it's about that as you look at the growth of standardized testing and standardized curricula. And it's about standardization. I believe we've got to go in the exact opposite direction. That's what I mean about changing the paradigm.
All right, so that's Ken Robinson, and that has us thinking about a lot of different angles to this question. So whether it's how we set up the classroom itself, how long classes are, who is taught which subjects at which ages, and standardized testing, we have a great deal to work with. Our listeners have already begun to weigh in, and I would only caution this. We have heard from parents who want later school start times. I understand that. That is sort of a question we're going to set aside for future discussions. This conversation is about what the physical classroom should look like, what the approach should be throughout the school day, how we evaluate students, how we test and whether we test, and a lot more if we started over tomorrow. My guests include Joanne Larson, Professor of Education and Associate Director of Research at the Center for Urban Education Success at the University of Rochester's Warner School of Education, and she's the author of Radical Equality in Education, Starting Over in U.S. Schooling. I've enjoyed this, and I'm really glad to have you. So we could probably talk all day about this. We got a lot to cram in.
Yes, we could talk all day about this.
Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Also here is Seth O'Brien. He's an upper school math teacher and commons coordinator at the Harley School. And Seth is someone who has thought, I think, a great deal, fair to say, Seth, about if we would make changes and what they might look like, yeah?
I think about it every day.
That's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having
and
me.
Back for a second visit this week is Kevin Maywison, who's Associate Professor of Teaching and Curriculum, a Social Studies Education Scholar, and Director of Teacher Education for the University of Rochester's Warner School of Education. Long time no see.
Thanks for having me back. It's nice to know that Monday wasn't such a horror show that
it
I'm
wasn't.
Never invited back
no,
again.
No, we enjoyed that greatly. I want to start with Joanne because we can't get through every concept in radical equality in education, but I guess I will start with you when it comes to what we are intending to do. Ken Robinson, in that talk, what stood out to me is not just the physical space, but the intentionality of what we're doing and the way we sort of separate students and make them feel like, well, you're a genius, but maybe college isn't for you, or why we decide what we do. If we were starting over tomorrow, how would we choose to evaluate students in a way that may be different than the way we evaluate them now?
I think I would start with what I make the case for in the book about the nature of intelligence. I think starting over has to start at a very basic level, which is that all intelligence is equal. And we could talk for days about what that means and all the permutations of that. And it certainly, it does impact assessment. But I think that how we would know would be how people are what people are doing that makes a change in the world, right? If we have a problem-posing education where everybody's intelligence is equally valued and equally brought to bear on the problem we're trying to solve, then you know, a basic assessment would be, is the problem solved? But also, what are people learning and how are people learning in the solving of that problem, in the endeavor? So it's ongoing, it's formative, the words that people use now.
Right. And if I remember correctly, you read about the difference between an assumption of equality versus an assumption of inequality.
Yes.
And just set that difference for us here.
Okay. So I think schools today, back your history was wonderfully put, assume right at the get-go inequality, that there are people who know and people who don't know, and that the people who know deliver what their knowledge or information to the people who don't know. And what I'm arguing is that that's where we have to change. Everybody knows. Everybody knows something, and everybody has valuable ways to think about an issue or a problem or a dilemma or a content, right, that could be brought to bear on solving a problem.
And if we do not, if we stick with this assumption of inequality instead mm-hmm. of that assumption of equality, because I want to make sure we have this distinction. I don't think you're saying everyone comes into every problem with an equally, sort of an equal amount of expertise or.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying so people don't have the same intelligence.
Right.
It's not about sameness. It's about value and a particular expertise or a particular way of seeing a problem. Like, diversity is a good thing, that you have varying ways to see things, and together you make a new thing. You create new knowledge, rather than what currently happens is it's the same regurgitated information and knowledge over and over, year after year, kid after kid. And the kids are viewed as empty and not knowing, and the teachers know. And so then you get this pattern, and they're sorted. There are more intelligent and less intelligent, and there are people who only need basic skills. And the research shows that those people are always end up being poor, African-American, Latinx, or whatever, right? It's the same people marginalized and claimed as unintelligent or not intelligent enough or not knowing enough, and the same people who know. And then so the goods of society are distributed unequally. So if we fundamentally start with equality instead of inequality, everything changes. And I don't think anything will change fundamentally as long as we hold that there's these assumptions of inequality.
Okay. And so before I turn to Seth and Kevin for their thoughts on this, one more follow-up would be then, if we're going to have this assumption of equality versus the assumption of inequality, what would that actually manifest? How would that manifest during the school day in terms mm-hmm. of what subjects are taught, how they're taught, how we sort of align classrooms? What would change?
I would say that contents wouldn't be separated. I think that you would have an issue or a problem or an area that you wanting to, and I'm sure Seth and Kevin can both talk about contents or problems in their areas. All the contents would come to bear on the solution. And there would be fluidity, it would be project-based, it would be movement. Starting over, I'm not arguing you tear down the buildings. I mean, you could make do with the buildings. They're not materially structured in a way that facilitates this kind of learning, but you can do it. But the focus is on learning, not instruction.
Okay. Seth O'Brien, we'll start with you on the question of what would change starting in the fall of 2017, if Seth O'Brien got to redesign schools, whether they're physical or sort of the intentionality of the educational process.
Awesome. Thanks, Evan. So I'm going to sort of make two points here, and I think ultimately they connect. If I was starting from scratch, the first thing we'd all be discussing is, what are our goals for our students? What type of students do we need to produce or want to produce? Are they going to be great critical thinkers? Are they going to be able to solve problems from multiple perspectives? And then everything's going to tie back to that. The schedule is going to support that. The classrooms are going to support that. The type of interdisciplinary classes are going to support that. So that's sort of one huge thing for me. And I do think there needs to be time set aside for field experience. And if you can't get the transportation for twice a month, hour and a half field experiences, then at least there's something online these days that there could be a collaboration with. And that time has to be set aside so that it doesn't interrupt other classes. So that would be a priority item to me because I value students being able to solve real life problems. I'm going to give an example that reaches back to what Joanne was talking about in terms of problem-based learning, essentially. You can do this in so many different ways. So we, this past year, a couple teachers and I did a project with a couple teachers from World of Inquiry and Headwater, Chris Hartman at Headwater, and it was called The Common Plate. So Chris Hartman just brought in this red bin of all miscellaneous vegetables and fruits from his produce that he collects. And we didn't get any information ahead of time about what the food was. We had computers and we had cooking materials. And so then students from World of Inquiry, students from Harley, did some icebreakers, broke up into small groups. And then they had to collaborate and use Google Chrome and research skills to come up with a recipe. And then they took this random food and made something to eat. And then they all ate together. I think that's a great example of sort of collaborative learning and problem-based learning. But what I was thinking about is, you could do math, we can do English from there, we can do history from there. I'm a math teacher from in background, whether it's just calculating how much produce we would need to serve X amount of people, whether it's, we want to start a business doing this. So we're gonna run a business that just does Common Plate. Because maybe Evan Dawson's having some friends over and he's looking for a fun, different activity to collaborate with his friends about. So the Common Plate student group is gonna come over and serve you. So we could do all the math to figure that out. We could then save money and look at exponential growth. I mean, English reading about the history of different food. So the other piece to that is, we hear all the time that student motivation is a big issue. So if I'm a student who then has learned about, done this food share, this food collective project, The Common Plate, and then it's like, I remember talking to World of Inquiry kids, and I remember cooking up a squash or some random thing, bok choy or whatever, I might be better at sitting in the math class and then sort of punching the numbers because it means something to me now, which it didn't before. So, long story short, I think a lab period where you can have long field experiences with other people outside of the classroom walls is priceless. My last thing while I have this sort of airtime. Why this is important, one example that I've learned from Harley is we have some amazing history teachers. And what happens is they have unbelievable discourse in the classroom. Very respectful, thoughtful, represent different perspectives. And then you would see the same kids, 5 minutes later in the hallway talking about a similar topic. And it's like all that they learned just went away for how to have civil discourse. And it's because kids, as long as we're in different content areas and sort of separated, they compartmentalize everything. So part of the field experience is taking what you learn in the classroom and making it actually as important as everything else.
I just have to say, I really appreciate the idea of bringing in food, making it tangible. You can teach kids at any age to memorize, I'll give you 10 pictures of, or just memorize definitions of what is this vegetable, what is this food. You can memorize it for a standardized test, and 2 weeks later you can take that test and you can spit it out, and then 2 weeks later you might have forgotten it. But if you hand a kid something and say, you have no idea what this is, work with your students, figure out what is it, how is it grown, create a recipe for it. Start to find those things on your own and then actually do it and eat it and serve it with your friends. That's an experience they'll remember. They will maybe have a skill that they can develop and take with them. And they, I think, will remember and absorb a lot more. But how are you going to standardize test that, Seth? Come on, man. That's really what this is about here, isn't
sure.
it?
Well, the other piece that I think Kevin and Joanne can talk much more eloquently than me about, which I think is the other big piece about this, is professional development. So there needs to be time set aside for teachers to address that question. So let's plan the awesome activity so the kids learn something. And then also let's make sure we have the follow-up so that the kids are converting that into the sort of goals we hope that they learn in terms of more tangible material. There were many years, I have more stories about failures than successes. And, I've tried to do a lot of project learning as a math teacher, and it often didn't go that well because the project would be awesome. You're like, oh, look at these kids doing cool stuff. And then to your point, a week later, it's like they didn't learn anything. Had I spent more time figuring out how to do the follow-up and how to, both in terms of the content and the method of instruction, if I had that professional development, I would probably be 100 times better as a teacher. So that needs to be in the schedule as well.
Joanne's book prioritizes teachers in these ways. We'll get into that a little bit later here, but I want to ask Kevin the kind of the same thing. And Kevin, Seth's example on critical thinking and how to create, you know, students who are not just able to spit out answers on a test goes right back to what we talked about on Monday.
Exactly.
Understanding the Declaration or understanding American history in a way that says, don't memorize the name of every president. Tell me the societal impact, the social impact of different. It's more important that you can articulate and understand how to reason these things. And I went right back to that. So right. Where do you start with how we're going to get there with students?
Well, so two of the things that Seth and Joanne just mentioned that I think are important are education that is problem posing and education that is both emergent and responsive. So in terms of problem posing, you know, things such as, you know, the sort of environmental degradation and the impacts on the natural world, like the climate and human activity, our interactions with geography, like that's a problem. And so kids have ideas about these problems. One of the things that we need to keep in mind educationally is that kids have ideas about things based on what they see, based on the people that they interact with, based on the things that they read. Similarly, you know, Seth just mentioned a situation in which in a history classroom they're having these great conversations and then they go out into the hallway and civil discourse just kind of falls apart. Kids have ideas about things like, you know, how should we interact with each other and how should we sort of live with each other? And so I think these questions that kids have ideas about and experiences with are really important starting points for this sort of problem-posing education that they discussed. But also going back to Seth's point about these things being sort of emergent, you know, when you start with problems, you don't have answers to those problems already. And so consequently, when you start with problems, both the teachers and the students need to have sort of models for dealing with those problems together. And that's where the sort of emergent and responsive part comes in. As things come up, teachers need to know how to respond to those things as questions emerge or as a problem with whatever investigation they're engaging with comes up. Teachers need to know how to respond to those things in real time. And so, you know, there are some challenges in terms of practice that have an impact on this kind of teaching. The other thing that I want to mention, though, is there are some much bigger challenges in terms of the context of public education in you know, in the United States in general, locally, statewide, that make these things challenges too. You know, I just use the word public education, and public implies that you have a lot of people involved, and those people are contesting issues associated with education as a public good, the most fundamental of which is what aims and ends should public education serve? But there are lots and lots of other issues that are implicated in this conversation, like, you know, who's paying for public education and how? And, you know, what should curriculum look like in a way that aligns with this kind of learning that we're talking about? And how should institutions be led and managed and organized? You know, how should education be sort of controlled democratically? You know, what roles should federal, state, and local governments play? Going back to Seth's point, how should teachers be educated, certified, retained, supported, et cetera? What kinds of relationships should schools foster with the communities in which they're situated? And there are all sorts of tensions associated with these questions as well. And then the implication of that is, well, who gets to decide how these tensions should be mediated and how these problems should be solved? So, you know, when you think about the way classrooms might look differently, you're 1 to 3 degrees of separation from also thinking about all of these big, huge issues.
Listeners, I hope this isn't just an academic conversation. And by that, I mean, Joanne even addresses in her book how to make this plausible, how to affect some of these changes. Seth is a teacher who's actively creating some of these changes. And Kevin is working with educational communities on this. But I do want to briefly ask our guests before we get to some of your phone calls. And I know the phone's ringing. And parents and listeners, we will definitely work in some of your feedback. But we could do this all day or all week. We only have the hour. So, Joanne, you do write about how to make this plausible. This is not just an academic conversation, but this is moving a big rock. If we're going to change the way schools are set up, how do we, you know, what's the short answer for how realistic it is to actually get there?
Well, short answer. That's hard to ask an academic. But I have to say that I am a part of the East U of R EPO. And so a lot of these ideas, I am clearly trying to do at East, right? And so there are best practices that exist already that you can try. We could not remove standardized testing. But I've been teaching there. I'm going to be teaching a class that students designed with students in the fall to try and work some of these things out within the system. In that book, I kind of was in a position of it can't work within the system because the system is too dysfunctional. However, the reality is that you have to start with the system. So I think it takes time. It takes the hard part, I think, is that it can't. Kevin's point about all of the things that come to bear in the classroom are all in the classroom, and you can't really separate it. You can't just, it all has to be done together. And that takes time, and things get lost. But I think the one thing I wanted to say that's really important is that students have to have a say. One of the points I make in the book is that kids are motivated. They're not motivated. They're taking their intelligence elsewhere because school is irrelevant. And what we want, because I do believe in public education, that it is a public good, is to make it so that they bring their intelligence back to school and help us solve some of these problems. And to do that, it has to be meaningful and engaging and interest-based and project-based. As Pedro Noguera said a few weeks ago, ask the kids. They will tell you what they need.
And possibly creative in their solutions.
Absolutely.
We may be hammering the creativity out of them with this old model. And we heard from a lot of parents already on Twitter. I say parents, a lot of people, a lot of educators who've said this idea of 30 desks and chairs aligned in rows, certain kids sit in the back and, mm-hmm. all of the assumptions and what that signals should just physically be blown up. And a lot of parents have said, put kids in circles, let them face each other, show a little bit more equality in the setup that way, or bigger desks, more communal learning, that kind of thing, a little bit more, maybe a more standing situation. Joanne, I know this is maybe a little less interesting than the actual intentionality of what we're doing day to day, week to week in schools, but the physical setup of classrooms, if we started tomorrow, would it look like it does today?
Absolutely not. It would not be rows. I mean, it needs to be circles, large tables, different areas of the classroom. And I remember, before the partnership with East, things were in rows. You will see different classroom organizations now. And sometimes it's one organization at one part of the class period, a different organization mm-hmm. at a different part of the class period because you're doing different things. So fluidity, movement that's organized to the problem that's getting addressed, not to the control, right? If you shift from teacher delivery to constructing, the physical space is going to look very different.
Seth, how much as a teacher do you feel the ability to make that change if you want it in your setting?
Well, I have some flexibility in sort of working at Harley, but I think two things. One, sort of design thinking approach. I love the idea of students, let's just take two class periods, first two of the year, and one of the big things we're going to talk about is what's the goal for you as a student in this classroom, and how can the space be arranged to support your needs? So I think letting, again, the students help figure out how to arrange the desks, bam, I think that's good. I sometimes get in a rut, and I like to walk down to our elementary school, and I think looking at elementary mm-hmm. classrooms, those are the best. They mm-hmm. have everything you're talking about, space to move, ways to arrange the desks so that if you need to get in rows, you can get in rows. If you need to go in a circle, you're going in a circle. Student work is decorated throughout the wall. So, but I think, in general, as a teacher, the best teachers are very creative. I've met a lot of teachers at different schools who are amazing, and if we just walked around and saw them in their classrooms, we would have it all figured out, I think. So I do think, in general, teachers have an ability to arrange their class good enough to do great learning in their classroom.
Let me read. I'll go around the table, start with Kevin, and then in our second half hour, we're going to get your phone calls. I'm going to read from Joanne's book. And again, the book is Radical Equality in Education, Starting Over in U.S. Schooling. It is short, but it is dense, and it is fascinating to think about, even if you don't agree with every point. And here, in sort of her part of her summation at the end, she says, remove high stakes testing. Just stop them. She said, we should replace them with ongoing authentic assessments of learning and development. Several other countries already do this. Assessments would be developed locally as long as there are no high stakes attached. Kevin, agree or disagree there?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, when we talk about sort of reinventing schools, I think it's an issue largely of reprioritization in some cases. An assessment is an example. So an assessment now with high stakes tests, we care, you know, a lot of the tests are sort of norm referenced. You know, we expect that there's going to be a normative performance on these tests. And so consequently, you know, with a norm reference test across an entire state where you're just kind of trying to figure out how kids are doing compared to other kids and your ranking and sorting and so on and so forth, what you care most about in that situation is the reliability of the items and sort of a concurrent validity, like, you know, is what's happening in one place going to happen? Does it correlate with what happens in another place? I don't think these should be huge concerns for classroom educators on a regular basis. I think the primary concern should be, you know, like this idea of ecological validity. Like, are the things that our kids are doing, are the things that we're assessing them on, are they good representations of the kinds of things that we would want them to do in society beyond the classroom? And so, you know, within a, you know, sort of problem posing education, you know, when we have sort of criterion referenced exams, that basically means that are they doing the things that we're asking them to do? We establish with the kids maybe a set of things, a set of criteria that we would expect them to meet. Are they meeting those criteria? Are they really good? Do they need some help? And if they need some help, what kinds of help are we providing to them to get them to a place where they're really good? I mean, this is a different set of decisions, really, in terms of assessment than decisions associated with, you know, how to help a group of kids get X score on an assessment so that, you know, they compare well with other kids, or so that the educators on which, you know, their performances, the educators' performance assessments are based on kids' test scores. That's a totally different, you know, way to do things.
Okay. Seth, what do you think about assessments?
That's a lot to process there. I mean, you know, I think there are some schools that have found a way to be able to have portfolios and project-based learning as part of their standardized testing. I think that that's amazing. I was thinking during this conversation about assessments, I've worked with some students who work way harder than I ever do, and just to, you know, get by on their math test. And I give more credence to their work ethic and the ability to solve a puzzle that they can't really solve. That is more impressive to me than anything I'm doing for them. Yet they're getting some grade that doesn't really make sense given their work ethic. So I think this idea of the assessment should correspond to what we want kids to be able to do in actuality is important. And it's not the right tool. Yeah.
And Joanne, I want to key in on something you say in your book, as you say assessments would be developed locally as long as there are no high stakes attached. I'm going to be out of my depth as I muse on something, and you can help me with the history if I'm right or wrong. You go back to Prussia. You go back to where some of the sort of the factory-like classroom setup was created and started to spread, and they wanted homogeneity. They wanted student worker bees. They wanted to train them for the jobs, to sort of plug them in as a society. Everybody learns the same thing. You learn these skills, and then when you're done with school, we can plug you in. In this country, you know, Common Core, I think at least they wanted some kind of standard core that we could be not homogenous in the way it was in Prussia, but homogenous in that we at least have a baseline that in this country, students will learn X, Y, and Z. And if we really kind of throw out standardized testing and leave it up to local control there, well, if you're in Portland or Tulsa, or if you are in Des Moines or Portland, Maine, you might be creating, you know, students, learners who are learning a lot of different things that don't necessarily line up. And should we be worried about that? Or is that something that says that's okay? The local control is more important. What do you think?
I think the global is in the local, in the sense that local doesn't have to mean just what people need to be able to do to function in Rochester. It's about being a human being in contemporary society. What do people need to know? We need to know history so we don't repeat. We need to know a lot of things. And if the local decision-making is made by all the constituents, and that the constituents are not all white middle-class men, then you're going to have a diversity of what needs to be known, right? And you will bring a variety of perspectives. A lot of American education has been about socializing people into being what certain people defined as American. And that just doesn't exist. We have nothing but diversity in this country, and that's a good thing. And we need to be able to function across groups, across languages, across races, across classes. And, you know, not only did people sort by worker bee, but it was worker bee at a lower level, worker bee at a medium level, and worker bee at a higher level, and elite class. So we have a class division that is fundamentally unequal and always marginalizes and oppresses the same group of people. And that can't continue. We need to be able to have, it's just not sustainable as human beings. And so the purpose or goal needs to include meaning making and being a human being with other human beings in living on this planet and solving the sustainability problem. So I propose this idea of scenario planning as curriculum development. And if you have all the people to, you know, the at the table, including most importantly students, whose planet, I mean, they're going to inherit this planet. We need to be able to, they need to be able to have a say in what it'll be like in all aspects, not just sustainability and ecology, but politics and religion and all those things, right? And they, yeah, I'm rambling, so I'm going
to
stop.
No, no, it's okay. No, but briefly, starting over tomorrow, standardized testing, when Joanne sets the school of tomorrow from scratch, standardized testing essentially doesn't exist at the high stakes level.
At the high stakes level, for sure. I think that
it's gone.
It is gone. The stakes attached are whose purpose are those stakes serving other than to sort and eliminate certain groups of people from making particular, you know, life pathways?
The adherents and the proponents would say it's teaching students about life and there are high stakes moments in life and we have to be able to perform and it prepares them for the quote unquote real world, quote unquote. Academics love that phrase.
Who's real world and who decides what that real world is? I mean, the idea that you can't get a high school diploma in New York State without passing five Regents exams is who decided that and who benefits from that decision? I'm not saying we don't want rigorous learning and we don't want rigorous understanding of the different contents. And we could establish that without the stakes, that you can't have this if you don't. And Rahm Emanuel wants to add, you have to have a job or an entrance acceptance letter to a college, or you can't get a high school diploma in Chicago. Why do that to people? So I understand assessment, and I understand rigor, and I understand intelligence. You know, we need all of those things. It's the stakes that make most people fail, actually.
All right, we're redesigning school days from scratch. Our engineer's gonna come through the glass if I don't get a break in, and then we're going to take your calls after this break. I know Kevin wanted to jump in with one more point there, so go ahead, Kevin, and then we'll get that break.
Yeah, so the local control conversation is one of those tensions that I mentioned a few minutes ago, one of those sort of tensions of organization and consistency and standards and practice, and I wanted to just sort of toss out a couple of examples that demonstrate how challenging that is. So imagine you're in Oklahoma, for example, where the oil and gas lobby impact curriculum and standards in Oklahoma, especially curriculum standards with regard to, say, science and climate and all that kind of stuff. There's some conflict in that state right now about the extent to which climate science should be represented in standards as well as local instruction and assessments. Similarly, you know, in the southern states in the 1960s, you know, in the textbooks there and in some of the local curricula, you know, we saw a sort of happy slaves narrative. You know, those are consequences in many ways of local control of people in a particular place saying, you know, these are the ideas that we want to impart to people here, whereas people beyond here might look at what the oil and gas lobby are doing in standards and curriculum in Oklahoma and say that's not right. And nowadays we might look at the happy slaves narrative and say that's ridiculous, but you know, local control. So there's that.
Yeah, I didn't say it would be easy.
Right, yeah, no.
Our guests are talking about what would schools look like and how would they function if we redesign them from scratch tomorrow. And it's not just academic. I mean, it would be easier to start tomorrow. But I think even with that moving that boulder uphill, there's some effort to get these changes enacted. Joanne Larson is a professor of education and associate director of research at the Center for Urban Education Success at the University of Rochester's Warner School of Education. Kevin Mawison is associate professor of teaching and curriculum
curriculum, a social studies education scholar, and the director of teacher education for the Warner School. And Seth O'Brien is here. He's an upper school math teacher and a commons coordinator for the Harley School. Your phone calls after our only break of the hour on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the city of Rochester now has a climate action plan. Does it align with what the citizens' climate lobby kind of wanted? There were a lot of local citizens, activists, asking the city to consider some changes. Well, what did the city of Rochester decide? What about targets for emissions? How aggressive are those targets? How does it align with the Paris Climate Agreement? We'll wade in next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Anna emails me and says, Evan, I want my kids to go to the schools your guests are describing. I hope administrators are listening. Tim in Pittsford says, it may be something small, but our kids that go to a public elementary school in Pittsford all have their desks set up in a circle or squares facing each other with plenty of space to move. So Tim says, you know, sort of a small thing, big thing. And I want to grab some phone calls. Bruce in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Bruce.
I'm just wondering what they think about the age in which children are starting school. We have so many kids that are ill-prepared, even from the suburbs and people who are well-to-do, don't necessarily have their kids. They're further ahead than where the city is, but don't necessarily have them with all the skill sets needed to start. And what they thought about universal pre-K and the importance of that in moving forward and getting our children educated.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate that.
It's a wonderful question, and I think that one way to maybe twist it a little bit is to say, how can schools be ready for kids? I think the way the schools are now, with the emphasis on skills and high stakes and standardization, it builds kids that are not ready for school. It should be the other way around, and so. And it also goes to the aims and purposes that Kevin was talking about. If the aim is to build critically democratic citizens, then the age they start, socialization, getting to know other kids, play is absolutely important in the early years. One thing we do get right in Rochester is early childhood education. And I think that universal pre-K can be very beneficial across race and class lines for building compassionate, caring human beings as they learn to play with each other and explore.
Dennis on Twitter says, art or music should be first. Get the mind moving. Then history or math, then lunch, then recess or gym, and then hands-on learning, tech, science, etc. Jason says, once a month, teacher versus student Nerf gun wars. Pete says on Twitter, Pete's asking, any chance you can take 30 seconds to define high stakes? This term means different things to different people.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So 30 seconds. My definition of high stakes would be that there are implications of the decisions that are made from the use of assessments on people's activities, livelihoods, interactions, etc. So, for example, when a kid can't graduate from high school because they haven't passed the requisite tests or haven't gotten the right grade on the requisite tests, that has real implications on their lives. And I'll actually sort of throw in this idea that many of those who oppose high stakes testing might suggest it comes from a guy named Campbell back in the 70s and is referred to sort of now as Campbell's Law. It's the idea that the more a measurement tool is used to make decisions about what people are going to do and how and why, the more likely it is that the use of that tool is going to corrupt that which it's designed to measure. So when an assessment is used in a way that has a real impact on people's livelihoods, and that assessment is designed to measure X, then the fact that it has that much impact on people is really going to corrupt the extent to which people know and are able to do useful things with the thing that's measured.
Okay, Joanne, good definition.
Excellent. Oh, yeah, nothing to add on that one. That's an excellent definition. It impacts people's futures, their real lives.
Ellen in Pittsford on the phone is next. Go ahead, Ellen.
Yes, first of all, I cannot thank you enough for bringing this conversation to the table at a time when I think learning is in crisis. But I've been at it 40 years, so why would I even say that? I started out in Canada 40 years ago realizing that the human brain doesn't equal or look like how it is we're trying to develop it. For 40 years, I then studied the brain and how that works in education, publishing many books with Pearson, Wiley, other places, developed a model that has won awards for higher motivation, higher achievement for older students, university and high school, in 20 countries. But what I find, and it's not being addressed at a major place, is the gatekeeping that keeps out revolutionary new brain-based exciting ideas that put learners at the center, that are so practical. For example, my students start with two-footed questions. They, if they want to look at a community that benefits all, they build one. We tell them exactly what's expected, and then we hand out our lectures and call them cheat sheets. Students love them. They then begin to move the mental resources into action. That includes at least 8 intelligences for every student, and it includes new neural discoveries like plasticity. So then you reflect where to from here, and the students begin to use this beyond class, and they actually literally, and I'm doing it here in the city right now, they literally lead a celebration of innovation where the parents, presidents of universities and such come out. But I keep hearing for 40 years that the universities lecture at us and tell us, well, they're too big not to. And so the gatekeeping needs to be addressed in more practical ways so that we who love revolution in education can be part of the answer.
Ellen, and thanks. Go ahead, Ellen.
And perhaps they'd show us how. These are experts. I haven't disagreed with one word I've heard, so I'll take my answer off the air. But, Evan, I do value you. You bring so many good voices to the table, so thanks.
Oh, Ellen, thank you. People must think she might be a sister or a relative. She's not. Thank you, Ellen. I appreciate that. Some thoughts from the panel we just heard there. Go ahead, Joanne.
I think her point about gatekeeping is important. And one of the things, as a university person, I'm not a lecturer. I'm not trying to be a gatekeeper, but I think the gatekeepers are what I could talk about in the book and other people's have, power elites or policy elites, so that people, the decisions being made about education right now are disastrous. I agree. It is a crisis. It's all about profit for corporations who will produce products to be used and destroying public education. And it's not about learning. It's about profit. And I think that how to do that, how to do that in the face of these gates and these oppressions, I think you have to just do it. And one argument people always say, it's such a big boulder, oh my God, oh my God, and then nothing happens. And so at East High School, we started. It's like you have to start pushing the boulder, and then you just continue to do it. And you're doing it at Harley, and we're doing it at Warren. You just have to keep doing the revolutionary act in spite of the pushback from above.
And Joanne, maybe on a future program, we should devote an hour to the question of what neoliberalism means. It's a term that comes up in your book.
Yeah.
And it's a term that comes up in a lot of conversation when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to education policy. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I've had to study and spend some time with. I see it come up in your book. So maybe on a future day, we'll come back and talk more about that.
Love to.
Because I think when we commoditize just about everything in society, mm-hmm. what happens is the Seth O'Briens of the world and Kevin Maywissons and Joanne, people like you, you're still working within a framework that seems really constraining. Ellen talked about gatekeepers. There's only so much you can do if the overall end goal is pass these tests to get these degrees. Is that right?
Absolutely. But I think that if you wait for the test to go away, that at this point, I don't see that happening. So you have to try anyway.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Because kids' lives are at stake.
Right. So if you were designing from scratch, which is the subject of the hour, you might not do that at all. Realistically, you've got to try to design within a system that has that. And what can you do? So that's some thoughts on sort of working within that system.
I mean, I do think there are some revolutionary teachers out there right now who do great things with their curriculum. They take risks. They try new things. I mean, I think there's this sort of fear of failure that holds a lot of us back in any industry. And some of the challenges in education are no different than challenges in some other industry. So I did just want to throw that out there that I think taking risks, collaborating, those are things that are happening now, just not enough of it. And in the short run, how do we promote more of that? How do we promote more teachers to learn from other teachers that are out there? I've been blown away by learning from a teacher at Genesee Chart, and the climate change is coming up in the next hour. Abby's great. There's a Rochester Youth Climate Leaders Group, and by working with that group of a student organization. I've been able to meet other teachers from other schools. I've learned a lot from them. You know, I've been involved with Great Schools for All, and that's another sort of group that's trying to break some barriers. And the more we can learn from each other and other districts, that's another sort of short-term thing, and learn about other schedules and other classroom arrangements. Those are things that can happen now.
Dave emails the program, and Kevin, I'll kick his question to you. He wants to know, if we started over tomorrow, would we have the same broad subjects? That's a good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. So I think, I hate to answer questions with questions, but this reveals another one of the sort of tensions in the design of education. It's a tension related to, you know, domain specificity or discipline specificity and, cross-disciplinary work. And so, you know, there are problems that cannot be solved simply by single discipline. So going back to the examples that I provided earlier, environmental degradation, that is not a problem that can be solved simply through science classes. It is not a problem that, policy related to environmental degradation is not a problem that can be solved or addressed simply through social studies classes. And so, oftentimes the disciplines that we have provide really important tools and procedures and language for dealing with problems. So as a history education guy, for example, I know that the discipline of history provides some great tools, for example, for helping students look at conflicting sources of information and to try to figure out how to determine which one is more credible, or looking at a situation in history and saying, well, why did people do that, or why did they make those decisions? They seem like really weird decisions. Understanding historical context and applying that language to that problem seems relevant. But going back to the sustainability thing, history and social studies, science, math, English, the arts, all wonderful. They're not going to give us enough tools to address those problems, on their own. And so this is where, the sort of cross-disciplinary stuff is important. We were talking before we came on the program about, teacher education programs in sustainability education, for example. And I sort of thought, well, we have teacher education programs at a lot of universities on history education and math education and elementary education, but we don't have a lot of programs on sustainability education. And so therein lies one of the limits of that sort of, the entrenchment or the siloing of disciplines. Yet at the same time, it's important to recognize the tools that these disciplines give us in terms of ways of thinking and ways of solving problems, that if we spoke across them and worked across them, perhaps we'd get a little bit further.
Another piece of that I find a little bit frustrating as a classroom teacher, I've been teaching math forever. I'm a math guy. I teach a senior elective called Math Topics, just sort of applied math. And I spend a lot of time arguing with my students or having to listen to them and reflect on what's math and what's not. And it's because they've spent all of these years in this sort of little space about what math is and numbers on a piece of paper. We might be in the workshop trying to make something, and that's all about spatial reasoning and measuring. And it's just when are we going to start doing math? And it's like, this is crazy. But it's because they've spent so much time in the silos of whatever the discipline is, that they have a warped sort of definition of what we're even talking about with this content area.
And there are great cross-disciplinary programs that exist. An example that comes to mind is the Mikvah Challenge, which is in the Chicago area schools. They call themselves a sort of an action civics program, and it's project-based, and it incorporates a lot of the things that we just mentioned on the show today are important, such as, sort of students' localized knowledge and understanding of civic problems in their communities, drawing from, disciplines or disciplinary expertise to help them make sense and solve those problems, questions coming from kids, and so on and so forth. So this is a great program. But again, the term civics, even the term civics implies cross-disciplinary knowledge. There is no discipline or domain of civics. Civics is a thing that we do. And so, the Mikvah Challenge's Action Civics program is inevitably, cross-disciplinary, which it has to be if it's going to be, truly sort of a problem posing kind of education.
Well, let me just sort of wrap this hour by saying our guests have all been answering questions on what schools can do differently, what design of the school day, the the intention of the curriculum and how it's designed, the impact of testing. What I leave this conversation with is this. I may not work in that educational setting, but I am a parent, and I have a five-year-old, and I am not going to just obsess over making sure he passes tests. I'm going to make sure that I feel like he can think critically and that we can answer questions together. We can think about the world, because schools have a lot of limitations that they're working within, and within those frameworks and constraints, and doing it admirably. But as a parent, I'm going to do my part as well, not just to say, hey, did you memorize all these things? What'd you get on that test? All right, let's go play baseball. There's more to that than that. I just want to thank our guests for giving us so much to think about. Her book is Radical Equality in Education, Starting Over in U.S. Schooling. Joanne Larson, great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Maywison, second visit this week from U of R's Warner School of Education, and it still doesn't feel like enough. It goes fast, doesn't it?
Bring me back for a show about like chocolate and wine. I'm totally in.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Kevin. Seth O'Brien, upper school math teacher and commons coordinator at the Harley School, and the teacher you wish you had. Thank you, Seth.
Thanks, Evan.
Nice having you. He was told there would be no math, but there was math. There's always math. More connections next.